Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today is the second full working day of the post-bailout era. Since the rescue package became law last Friday, the Dow Industrials are down about 1,000 points. A great headline number, you'll probably see it someplace tomorrow. But that's not the real story. Because today, the Federal Reserve really became the lender of last resort. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 7th of October, and it's good to have you here this Tuesday as we continue with Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis. You know, it's been a while since we've heard from the Federal Reserve directly on the state of play in the credit squeeze. They remedied that in a very big way today. We will explain Washington's expanded role in American business. And financials led the way lower on Wall Street. That's a fancy way of saying bank stocks got clobbered today. Maybe it's because they're not making any money. Ben Bernanke's been doing all he can to change that. He has pumped hundreds of billions of dollars into the banking system, and today he reached deep into that financial toolbox yet again, this time to shore up the $1.6 trillion commercial paper market. Those are short-term loans that companies take out to cover immediate needs for cash, to pay workers or buy supplies, for example. It's also a direct injection of the Fed into corporate cash flows, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Over 1,700 businesses use commercial paper loans, but the market has shrunk by about $150 billion in the last few weeks, as lenders worry that credit-squeezed companies won't pay them back. So the Fed announced it will make loans for 3 months to eligible companies. During a speech to economists in Washington today, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said the move is designed to unfreeze credit markets.
The expansion of Federal Reserve lending is helping financial firms cope with reduced access to their usual sources of funding.
In some cases, the Fed will not require collateral, although borrowers will pay upfront fees. Bob Reed, an analyst with the BNet business website, says the Fed is betting that money will begin to flow again.
Bernanke is taking a gamble here that says, look, I need to restore confidence not only to the economy as a whole, but specifically to the credit market, which has been tightening so dramatically over the last couple of weeks. So he's trying to send a signal to lenders and borrowers that the government will back up their play.
The Fed essentially has unlimited resources to make commercial paper loans. But if companies don't pay back, the federal deficit swells and interest rates rise. Villanova University professor Victor Lee says the Fed finds itself in an uncomfortable position.
This is really something that the Fed doesn't typically do. They can intervene in this way, but typically they would rather have financial markets work themselves out in terms of the commercial paper aspect of the market.
Credit markets eased a bit after the Fed's move on hopes the government loans will relieve a cash shortage for many companies. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right, so there you have the macroeconomics of this whole thing, the really big picture. But what about somebody whose view is necessarily smaller? Say, a mid-sized company with those supplies to buy or payrolls to meet. How does commercial paper get them from one day to the next? We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to give us today's explainer.
Commercial paper is, well, I'll let Ken Boschman, an economist with Global Insight, explain.
Commercial paper is just simply put an IOU, usually short-term lending, 3 months to 6 months into the future.
So who uses these IOUs? Big companies and institutions. For an example, let's create a fictional coffee wholesale business. According to Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, the company might want to use commercial paper to fund its initial purchase of coffee.
They haven't sold any yet. Because of that, they don't have any cash on hand, so they take a loan, essentially, by selling commercial paper into the market.
Lowe says companies mostly use commercial paper to fund things like inventory or payroll.
Maybe they are counting on a big sale at the end of the month, but they need to send the checks to their employees in the middle of the month.
Where is the money coming from? Most commercial paper is bought by money market funds, Again, Ken Boschman.
It is a favorite of the money market mutual funds because, you know, usually it's pretty high quality.
But due to the financial crunch, the market for commercial paper has dried up, making it difficult for companies to get short-term loans. Hence the actions by the Fed, which said today that it will make some of those loans itself. That could be a big boon to companies looking to shore up inventories ahead of the holiday season. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
One last thing Fed-related before we move on to for-profit banks. You know, things are serious when Americans cut back on their credit card use, and that is exactly what's happened. The Fed reported today that consumer credit, that's everything except mortgages, basically, that number shrank last month for the first time in a decade. One of the banks that issues a lot of that consumer credit, Bank of America, has jumped the earnings gun. Financial companies weren't due to start reporting profits until next week, but I guess B of A wanted to get the pain over with quickly last night. Earnings fell 68% over the same period last year. CEO Ken Lewis said he's going to cut dividends to hang on to his cash. Seeing as how B of A is one of the healthier banks out there, that's not such a good omen for the rest of them now, is it? Ashley Multite reports.
Consumers are fleeing the stock market and stashing their savings. That's good news for banks, who need the deposits to cope with tight credit conditions and a mound of delinquent loans. But it won't be enough, says Bernie Baumol of the Economic Outlook Group.
I think what the banks are really struggling to do is to cleanse their balance sheet and improve their capital, because that's really the only way they'll be able to lend again in the future, is that they have some extra capital as a cushion against future losses.
Behemoths like Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase bought a bit of a cushion when they acquired other institutions. Stuart Plesser covers the banks for Standard & Poor's. He says that gives them the edge over their competitors.
So that when this is over, there's going to be a clear bifurcation in the banking space, where the bigger players will have a clear advantage of those who didn't have the capital to make the moves that these banks have made.
It still may not be enough. Bank of America said yesterday it's padding its cushion by raising $10 billion. And it's still not clear when the write-downs of those poisonous investments will end. Gerard Cassidy of RBC Capital Markets says the third quarter will be bad, but there'll be worse to come.
When the banks report their fourth quarter results in January, we will see the proverbial kitchen sink quarter, where the banks will throw in everything at the end of the year to try to clean up the books for 2009.
He says early next year could be the peak for bad bank news. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
And that is not something Wall Street would have wanted to hear today. The trend line kept creeping lower and lower. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is a time when free market types really have to be sure of themselves to stick to their guns. The biggest bailout, or rescue, in this country's history is unfolding right before our eyes. Just today, we had the lender of last resort, as I mentioned, the Federal Reserve, plug itself directly into the corporate finance structure. Throw in Fannie and Freddie, AIG, and Bear Stearns, and it's fair to ask, who's next? Because commentator and economist Susan Lee says the era of laissez-faire economics is over.
For the past 25 years, presidents have promised to reduce the size of government. They vowed to create a leaner, more productive state. But the result has been more of the same old bureaucratic giant. Consider Ronald Reagan, who came into office after campaigning vigorously to reduce the size of government. But 8 years later, by most measures, nothing much had happened. Since Reagan, no administration has been able to announce, "Hey, honey, I shrank the government." Even though the political will may be lacking, the economic argument for less government intervention is as powerful as ever. Government solutions don't work. In fact, they usually generate more and bigger problems. Just take a look at monetary policy. Back in 1998, when the giant hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management went under, the Fed rushed to the rescue. Tons of unnecessary dollars were pumped out. Those dollars generated the dot-com bubble. When that bubble burst in 2001, the Fed again threw dollars at the crisis, generating the housing bubble. And when that bubble burst last year, the Fed once again shoveled out more dollars, which will eventually create another crisis. The same perverse effects happen on the fiscal side as well. Increases in government loans for college students have ratcheted up tuition. Tax policy, designed to help lower-income families, has created a nightmare of complicated tax returns for everybody. Advocates of smaller government have bobbled the ball by arguing that big government is wasteful or not constitutional. They're right. But the slam dunk is to point out the obvious. Big government is counterproductive. It creates unintended consequences right and left. Okay, so you're not going to hear this from McCain or Obama. You're not even going to hear it from the Libertarian candidate. It's the kind of argument economists make, and of course, nobody listens to us.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. Take a second to drop us a line wherever you live, whoever you listen to. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. It doesn't take too much imagination to see that the credit crisis either will or has already trickled down to the rest of the economy, and that Wall Street might be leading America down the road to ruin. Marketplace's Tess Vigeland has been driving cross-country for the past week or so. She and I and our colleague Amy Scott are going to meet up in St. Louis for a special broadcast this Friday. And Tess, we had you on yesterday from Denver. Where'd we track you down today?
Well, Kai, after an eight-hour drive from Denver, I arrived just in time for dinner in Lincoln, Nebraska, at the home of Dave and Melody Landis. They have a weekly family dinner with their son Matt and their daughter Melissa and their spouses. So I asked them to introduce themselves and tell me a little bit about, you know, what they do. And the granddaughter piped up with a little bit about herself.
This is Naomi. I'm 6 years old.
And what do you do for a living?
Make friends.
And I try to do that for a living too, Kai.
Yeah, nothing like kids at a family dinner. What did they have to say, these folks, about the economy and what's going on?
Well, it's more like what they didn't say. This was one spirited dinner conversation. And I have to say, Kai, that people out here on the road are still talking about the Wall Street rescue package and what it will or won't do to solve the crisis. Patriarch Dave Landis is in the camp that believes it was a necessary evil, especially to save small business owners from having to lay off employees because they can't get financing because of the credit crunch.
The bailout, if it was just for people who gave bad mortgage or took out bad mortgages, I wouldn't have much sympathy for, and I wouldn't mind if that went south. But that amount of money taken out of the economy stops legitimate businesses and people who have done nothing wrong from being able to do their lives.
And it was interesting, by the way, to hear the different reactions from Dave and Melody, who are 60, and their grown kids who are in their 30s. The stock market is, of course, much more of an immediate worry for the parents, so they're more inclined to say, hey, you know, do whatever you need to do to stanch the bleeding. Matt and Melissa were looking pretty much more long-term at what all this might mean, you know, 30, 40 years down the road.
What are they saying, though, Tess, about the fact that it's going to be a while before we even know if the package works?
You know, they're not really paying attention to the nitty-gritty details of the package, but I will say there was concern about whether this package will help change the system, and that's really what Melissa McKibben worried about.
I think that's my deepest hope. If this is an indication of change, that suddenly business is more regulated, if this means more fiscal conservative behavior both on the part of the consumer and on the part of business and on the part of the government, I think that would be, okay, $700 billion is always going to be a lot of money, but $700 billion that was well spent.
Tess, I'm guessing we're pushing up against checkout time at the hotel there. Where are you off to next, and what are you going to do?
Well, tonight I'm off to a small town near Independence, Missouri, and tomorrow morning I'll be checking in with a high school economics class to see what lessons they're learning from this fiscal mess. So 1,750 miles down, just 450 to go.
Just 450 to go. Tess Vigeland out there looking for the road to ruin. Thank you, Tess.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, Americans overseas and staying there.
So I think in general, people here are just much more willing and interested in trying to help out and make sure that, everyone is taken care of.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shed 508 points today, 5.1% to finish at 94.47. The Nasdaq parted with 108 points, 5.8%, ended at 1754. The S&P 500 shrank by 60 points, 5.75%, closed at 996. Bank of America plunged more than 26% today. Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch were close behind with 25% drops apiece. J.P. Morgan sank 10%. Alcoa, the aluminum company of America, fell 7.75% before the bell, down along with the rest of the market. But it regained nearly as much in after-hours trading on a stronger-than-expected quarterly profit report. General Electric dimmed 5%. American Express expressed itself 6% lower. Bond prices fell. The 10-year T-note, the yield there rose to 3.5%, 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Want to know what our hosts and reporters are experiencing as they cover America's financial crisis? You'll find their stories, insights, and observations at our website. Head to marketplace.org and look for the staff blog.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. General David Petraeus gives a talk at the Heritage Foundation about the United States' mission in Iraq. The Swedish Academy of Sciences announces the 2008 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. And on this day 7 years ago, President George W. Bush created the Office of Homeland Security. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
While it's often said that revenge is a dish best served cold, my interview on that topic last week with Duke economist Dan Ariely got a whole lot of you hot under the collar. We talked about how maybe, just maybe, people who were opposed to the bailout bill were upset because it didn't do enough to punish those responsible for the crisis. Of the many, many emails we got, we'll pick just two to summarize how most of you felt. First, Louise Castle from Clarkston, Michigan.
It's not about revenge for me, though I want a lot of people punished. It's about trust. I don't trust this as the disaster, they say, that these bills will fix the real problems, whatever they are, that anybody will be forced to do business honestly, or that it'll help me or any of Main Street.
Dan McGee from Reno, Nevada said revenge is beside the point.
I think what is happening with regards to the rage the voters feel comes from the appearance that billions of our money is going to be thrown down a rat hole and executives who should have known better will be able to walk with millions.
Michael Belzer teaches industrial relations at Wayne State University. He wrote to say Ariely was right on for two reasons.
It satisfies our behaviorally rational need to punish transgressors, and it builds punishment designed to discourage them from doing more of the same. Up to now, with a deregulated environment, it has not made economic sense for them to act prudently, and their imprudence led us to the abyss.
We also had Chris Mayer on the program last week. He's a professor of real estate and economics at Columbia. In a commentary, he said the federal government ought to do something to lower mortgage rates, that letting home prices keep on falling isn't going to help anybody. Andrew Levitt wrote from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to say that he sees the troubled housing market differently.
Maybe it doesn't help people who already own houses. But for first-time buyers like myself, the housing market is still way overpriced. Let's let those prices come back down so that people in my generation can buy a normal home in a nice city.
Finally, whether you want revenge or not, it is clear that a lot of people blame Wall Street for the financial mess, or they blame the government for not regulating big banks. Sal Incorvaia from New York City says there is somebody else that's responsible, too.
Who's to blame? We are, because we didn't stay informed enough and proactive enough and allowed the Fed, the government, Fannie, Freddie, the banks, the SEC, and finally Wall Street to prey on us all.
And with that, an end to the blame game, unless you want to blame us for something, in which case, it's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Given that most of us don't work anywhere near Wall Street, we don't trade in credit default swaps or worry too much about the overnight lending rate for big banks, it's easy to tune out the particulars of the financial crisis news du jour. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports those particulars are already affecting regional economies all over the country.
For decades, Georgia could bank on one thing. Its economy was probably better than the rest of the country's. Not right now. Michael Thurmond is the state's labor commissioner.
This is Georgia's highest unemployment rate in more than 15 years.
And initial unemployment claims are up 72% from last year. Thurmond's keeping unemployment offices in Georgia open at least 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, to process all the claims.
Job losses have been across the board, from residential construction to manufacturing, and most troubling now, we're beginning to see losses in the retail sector.
The first wave of job losses came in construction after the housing bust, but economist Stephen Levy says a new wave's on the horizon.
We're really at the whim of the consumer now, and I'm fairly pessimistic.
Levy's worried consumer spending could soon crumble and hurt local economies like Elkhart, Indiana, that missed the housing craze.
A lot of Midwestern common sense around here.
Kyle Hannon's at Elkhart's Chamber of Commerce. The small city never had a housing bubble, but it's feeling the pop. Its economy is all about building RVs, those big, gas-guzzling motorhomes.
People who lost a lot of wealth suddenly weren't buying RVs. That wasn't an option for them anymore.
That's meant big layoffs, and Elkhart's unemployment rate has more than doubled in the past 12 months. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
President Bush spent some time working the phones today. He was on the line with European leaders trying to coordinate a global response to the credit crisis. Finance ministers from the group of seven industrialized countries are set to meet in Washington at the end of this week. The White House said today, by the way, that the president's not opposed to tacking a leaders' meeting onto that one. Our looming presidential election is playing into the economic mix, too, especially for Americans living overseas. There are about 250,000 American expats in the United Kingdom. And in today's installment of our election series, Interested Parties, Marketplace's Stephen Beard gives us a bird's-eye view of their economic concerns.
In this pub in West London, an expat dolefully watches an American football game on TV. But it's not the game that's getting him down. Matt Peake from Texas is depressed about the American economy.
Actually, I'm kind of worried because I'm trying to sell my house right now back in Texas, and it's a little iffy.
Peake is in his early 30s and teaches school here. The turmoil of recent weeks has convinced him to stay put.
Economically, do you feel more secure here than perhaps you would feel back in the U.S.?
Much so. It's just America, everything back home, it's not a place that I want to be right now. I love it to death, but with what's going on in the American economy, I'd rather stay here.
Nicole Hayes, who's at the pub too, feels the same. Nicole is a 29-year-old office worker from Boston. She just married an Englishman. What would it take for them to move back to the U.S.?
What I would need with the things that are important to me right now, the best life that we can have as a couple and eventually, hopefully, as a family. So to me, the country would have to be a lot more stable and I would have to feel a lot more secure.
Though the UK is lurching into recession, Nicole says it feels less volatile and safer here. And she particularly likes the state-run National Health Service.
Couldn't believe it when I came here because, I mean, I don't have to bring my wallet to the doctors with me. And that's something I don't have to worry about. I know that the UK probably isn't considered to have the best system. But when you come from a place that has no system at all, I think it's easy to be really surprised and impressed with it.
The free healthcare you get from the NHS is important, though.
Definitely. It definitely is important.
In his office, high up over London's financial district, Bob Anibali has different concerns. He's a global director of a huge American institution. He lives here and not in his native New York because he's gay and he has a British civil partnership. That gives him and his British partner the same rights as a married couple.
That means that we can live and work anywhere in the European Union completely
in a normal situation, from tax perspective, from immigration perspective, from divorce perspective, or housing rights or employment benefits, but not the United States.
So that would have to change. Civil partnerships would have to be recognized in the States before you would go back and live there with your partner.
Yes. I mean, today, that isn't, my family isn't recognized there.
Would you like sugar?
Gwen Joseph plans to go back to Michigan. She and her husband aim to retire in about 4 years. Gwen says she would like the U.S. government to follow the British example and provide better public services, from health care and education to taking care of the homeless.
So I think in general, people here are just much more willing and interested in trying to help out and make sure that, everyone is taken care of.
But now she's afraid the U.S. won't be able to afford better public services, and she's worried that the Wall Street rescue package will further swell America's huge national debt.
We have two children who are adults that have families. We have grandchildren, and I don't want my granddaughter to be having to pay off debt that we're incurring now.
All of these expats are anxious about the state of the U.S., but they all believe America will pull through the crisis, and one way or another, all of them say they want to go back one day. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to put the financial crisis into a really personal context. It didn't get a lot of attention in the midst of a 508-point drop on the Dow, but Peter Orszag, the head of the Congressional Budget Office, was on Capitol Hill today. The House is looking into the impact of the credit squeeze on retirement accounts. And get ready for a really big number here. Orszag said that his best guess is that public and private pension funds combined with personal retirement accounts have lost as much as $2 trillion over the past 15 months. Works out to about 20% or so. And speaking of percentage declines, that is Marketplace from American Public Media, where the Dow fell 5.1% today. That's 508 points, as I mentioned. The Nasdaq lost 108 points, 5.8%. The S&P 500 dumped 60 points, 5.75% on that particular index. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Our coverage of the financial fallout continues tomorrow on the Morning Report when we redefine Wall Street.
As a metaphor for what American capitalism is all about, both in its worst aspects and in its best, Wall Street will always occupy a preeminent place in American life.
And on Marketplace, a pit stop in Detroit, Amy Scott brings us the latest from out on the road to ruin. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.